Content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is the Week Magazine. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the February 13th, 2026 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week is set in front of a Fulton County, Georgia elections office. In the foreground, we see Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard, and she's flanked behind her by Attorney General Pam Bondi and FBI Director Kash Patel. All three of them are holding boxes labeled ballots, and the headline is Start of the Steal, the Fulton County Raid, and the Threat to the Midterms. We get that on our Controversy of the Week. We'll start with the first main story. Democrats push for ICE accountability. What happened? White House Border Czar Tom Homan this week announced that he was pulling 700 immigration agents from Minneapolis and refocusing the enforcement blitz there, as Democratic lawmakers demanded Congress place new restrictions on immigration and customs enforcement and other agencies they say have descended into lawlessness. Homan, whom President Trump put in charge of the operation as outrage swelled over the killings of protesters Renee Good and Alex Pretty, cited unprecedented collaboration from local officials who are allowing ICE to take custody of undocumented inmates before they are released from jails. He said there would be a shift away from broad street sweeps to operations focused on immigrants with criminal records. But Homan stressed that Trump was still committed to mass deportations. If you are in the country illegally, he said, you are not off the table. Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey called the reduction a step in the right direction, but noted that with about 2,000 agents still on the ground, it was not de-escalation. Homan's announcement came a day after U.S. citizens who had been shot and violently detained by immigration agents testified at a Capitol Hill forum organized by Democrats. "I struggle every day with the pain and the suffering," said Marimar Martinez, 30, a Chicagoan who was shot five times by a Border Patrol agent after she tailed the officer's vehicle in her car. Good's brother Luke Ganger told the forum that federal agents' aggressive actions are changing the community and changing many lives, including ours, forever. House Democrats released a report slamming agents' unlawful tactics as lawmakers voted to end a partial government shutdown and negotiated over new accountability measures that would be built into a funding package for the Department of Homeland Security. DHS is completely out of control, said Representative Robert Garcia, Democrat from California. Congress has a responsibility to step in. In Portland, Oregon, Mayor Keith Wilson demanded agents leave the city after they lobbed tear gas at demonstrators, including young children, engaging in a peaceful protest outside an ICE facility. In Minnesota, federal judge Patrick Schultz decried ICE's defiance of court orders, saying the agency has ignored at least 96 judicial directives this year. That should give pause to anyone, no matter his or her political briefs. Who cares about the rule of law, wrote the George W. Bush appointee. What the columnist said. Tensions in the Twin Cities remain high, said Lewis Krause in the Minneapolis Star Tribune. But residents, protesters, and city officials report a seeming change in agents' tactics. They include fewer ICE caravans, fewer agents on foot rousting pedestrians, and fewer confrontations with protesters. But intense fights still break out daily between agents and protesters following them. Videos posted on social media this week show agents pointing guns at observers, trailing them in an SUV, forcing them out of the vehicle, and then detaining them. In neighborhoods once alive with the pulse of immigrant communities, the crackdown has fractured families, rattled worried neighbors, and left residents feeling unsafe, said Alaa Elaser in CNN.com. Ryan Strongjord never imagined he'd see his tree-lined, lake-dotted hometown transformed into a battleground by what he likens to a military occupation. U.S. citizens and immigrants alike are choosing to stay home and keep their kids out of school, he said. There's just overall a feeling of fear and dread. Far from de-escalating, ICE is seeking to expand its authority, said Noah Feldman in Bloomberg. The agency has authorized officers to arrest anyone they suspect of being undocumented, even if agents lack a warrant and the person isn't a flight risk. That license for agents to grab just about anyone they want came on the heels of another legally indefensible memo, which said officers could enter homes of suspected undocumented migrants without a judicial warrant. It reveals an agency bent on making its agents into all-powerful police force. Judge Schiltz flags another alarming trend, said law professor Ryan Goodman in The New York, the growing lawlessness of an administration engaged in flagrant defiance of court orders. The nearly 100 cases Schiltz cited included repeated instances where the administration has refused orders to release detainees or present them in court, or has transferred them to other jurisdictions against direct orders. Their contempt of court is truly extraordinary and may be moving us toward a constitutional crisis. Such actions are unsettling Americans, and not just Democrats, said William A. Galston in the Wall Street Journal. More than a third of 2024 Trump voters said in a Politico poll that while they backed the president's mass deportation campaign, they disapprove of how it's being done. In a Harvard-Harris poll, majorities said federal agents have gone too far and are violating civil liberties, while a Pew poll found that Americans by wide margins think it unacceptable for agents to stop and question people based on their appearance or the language they speak. Time will tell if the administration's de-escalation talk is sincere or just a cheap PR dodge, said Andrew Egger in The Bulwark. But even if it's the former, these systems now have a logic of their own. Homeland Security has systematically built ICE into something that looks less like a disciplined law enforcement agency than a small paramilitary force. Recruiting bigoted meatheads with anti-immigrant propaganda and sending them into U.S. cities with minimal training. Once you've created the monster, it won't be easily tamed. And the controversy of the week, Fulton County, a dress rehearsal for election theft. When FBI agents raided an elections center in Fulton County, Georgia last week, carting off 700 boxes of ballots and related documents, some commentators shrugged that it was just another doomed attempt by President Trump to substantiate his big lie of the stolen 2020 election. But the real goal is likely far more nefarious, said Mary Ellen Klass in Bloomberg. Facing a GOP wipeout in November's midterms, which would end his ability to fend off accountability, Trump is mobilizing the government to find or create evidence of electoral malfeasance in Democratic precincts as a pretext for Republicans taking control of ballots in key states in November. Trump himself has confirmed the plan this week, declaring that he wants to nationalize the elections and have the federal government, meaning Republicans, tally ballots in states he deems guilty of electoral corruption. His lackeys are ready to do the dirty work. Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard, Trump's de facto voter fraud czar, was on site for the Fulton raid. By statute, the nation's top spy boss is barred from involvement in domestic law enforcement. But as White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt explained it, Gabbard is committed to ensuring a U.S. election can never, ever be rigged again. Trump will certainly try to tamper with the midterm, said Nick Cottagio in the Dispatch. But to understand last week's raid, we shouldn't discount the president's aggrieved paranoia about Georgia, and Fulton County in particular. Bogus tales of shenanigans by black poll workers at Atlanta's State Farm Arena are among Trump's favorite lies to explain his 2020 loss in the Peach State. And it was Fulton's district attorney, Fannie Willis, who later indicted Trump for trying to overturn the election, including by pressuring Georgia's Secretary of State to find 11,780 votes, forcing him through the humiliation of fingerprinting and a mugshot. This raid may have been partly revenge for those indignities, partly preemptive therapy for the right's next painful election defeat. This is about more than simply keeping Trump happy, said Philip Bump in MS.now. Days before the raid, Attorney General Pam Bondi wrote to Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, suggesting the Trump administration would withdraw ICE agents from his state if he handed over all the state's voter records. Minnesota, one of two dozen mostly Democratic-led states the administration has sued to get their voter rolls, refused the request. Is the big plan to identify and purge Democratic voters, or merely to gin up more bogus claims of fraud? We don't know, but the threat to American democracy could not be more villainous if it were spelled out in letters clipped from newspapers and magazines. The president's gambit is working, said Jeet here in The Nation. Even if Gabbard and FBI boss Kash Patel find no crimes in Fulton, and even if Democrats recapture the House in November, Trump will point to stunts like the Georgia raid to justify ignoring congressional oversight. We're facing horrors far worse than that, said David French in the New York Times. The administration is already defying court orders and is already deploying masked agents to terrorize Latino and minority communities. In November, how many minority voters will risk a trip to their polling station? And how many, when they get there, will find they're no longer on the voting rolls? Yes, it's only February, but Trump is stealing the midterms, or trying to, right in front of our own eyes. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for candor. After government lawyer Julie Lee, asked by a Minnesota judge to explain why ICE and Homeland Security have defied so many court orders lately, expressed her own frustration with noncompliance and her crushing workload. Quote, "The system sucks. This job sucks," Lee told the judge. She was removed from her post soon after. It was a good week for Renaissance men. After researchers announced that they may have recovered fragments of DNA belonging to artist and polymath Leonardo da Vinci, extracted from Holy Child, a circa 1510 chalk drawing, the DNA could, if authenticated, settle the authorship of disputed masterpieces. It was a good week for vote rigging. After New York Magazine reported Representative Nancy Mace, Republican from South Carolina, once ordered a staffer to go on Reddit forums about the hottest women in Congress and boost her standing in the rankings. A Mace spokesperson called the allegations ridiculous. But it was a bad week for playing soldiers. After a man presented to an emergency room in Toulouse, France, with a World War I artillery round lodged in his rectum. After removing the item, surgeons alerted the local bomb squad, who determined the shell did not represent a risk of explosion. It's a bad week for polar bears. After Polar Plunge Myrtle Beach, a cold water swimming event to raise funds for the Special Olympics, was canceled due to dangerously cold temperatures. Organizers told the South Carolinians who would have participated to stay home, stay warm, and stay safe. Finally, it was a bad week for cybersecurity. after Madhu Gautamukala, interim head of the U.S. Cyber Defense Agency, uploaded sensitive contracting documents to a public version of ChatGPT, making the information available to the AI chatbot's more than 700 million users. Spokesperson said the agency remained committed to harnessing AI. The title of the briefing this week is The Price of Sporting Glory. The Milan Cortina Winter Olympics kicked off this week. Will Italy regret playing host? Was Italy ready for the games? Not entirely, but the Winter Olympics are now underway, and over the next 2 weeks, more than 3,500 athletes from 93 countries will compete across 16 sports, ranging from alpine skiing to luge to figure skating. These Olympics are the most geographically spread out of any games in history, with 25 sporting venues and 6 Olympic villages spanning some 8,495 square miles in northern Italy. The two main hubs, the city of Milan and the alpine resort of Cortino d'Ampezzo, sit 250 miles apart. Construction delays and cost overruns had plagued the games. Days before the opening ceremony, work was still ongoing at the Santa Giulia Arena, a new $292 million ice hockey venue in Milan. It was originally budgeted at $210 million. Some locals have been angered by the event's environmental cost. Cortina Mayor Gianluca Lorenzi received death threats after centuries-old trees were felled to make way for a $131 million bobsledding track. Lorenzi insists that the project is an added value for Cortina. But history shows that the Olympics often leave behind a legacy of debt, white elephants, and bitterness. How much did these games cost? The Milan Cortina Olympics have an operating budget of about $1.9 billion, which is largely covered by broadcasting and sponsorship deals and sales of tickets and merchandise. But that budget does not include capital cost, including the construction of new Olympic venues or improvements to rail and road systems. The Italian government allocated about $4.2 billion in public money for infrastructure spending. The International Olympic Committee argues that the games pay for themselves by raising a city's profile and attracting tourists. And some reports suggest Milan Cortina could deliver a $6 billion economic boost. But most host cities do not see positive return on investment. Beijing spent $40 billion on the 2008 Summer Games and generated only $3.6 billion in revenue, while London 2012 spent $18 billion and generated $5.2 billion. For many cities and many countries, said sports economist Robert Bade, the Olympics are a money-hemorrhaging endeavor. Why are the games so expensive? It's partly because they've expanded to allow more events, more athletes, more venues, and more spectators. But it's also due to each host city wanting their games to be more impressive than their predecessors. One-upmanship, extravagant architectural plans, and a comparatively short construction schedule result in big bills, which are often not reflected in the original bids. An Oxford University study found that from 1960 to 2016, host cities went over budget by an average of 156%. For some games, the cost overrun was far higher. The 2014 Winter Games in Sochi cost Russia at least $30 billion, 289% more than was expected at the time of bidding. And the 1976 Games in Montreal went 720% over projections, leaving the city with a $1.5 billion debt that took almost three decades to pay off. There's this kind of relentless underestimation of costs, said sports historian David Goldblatt, because if anyone knew the real bill at the beginning, they would never sign up. Only one host city has turned a profit in recent decades, Los Angeles. It was the sole bidder for the 1984 games after the Montreal debacle and insisted that most events be held in existing facilities. L.A. ended up with a surplus of over $200 million on revenue of $619 million. What happens to new infrastructure? Ideally, arenas and other facilities get repurposed when the athletes go home. A 2022 IOC report claims that 85% of venues built for past Olympics remain in use. Rome's Olympic Stadium, built for the 1960 Games, is now home to soccer clubs Roma and Lazio. And the colossal National Aquatic Center, used in Beijing 2008, is today a popular water park. But many facilities fall into disrepair because they are too expensive to repurpose or simply not needed. A $38 million aquatic stadium in Rio de Janeiro was left to crumble after the 2016 Games, while Athens is littered with decaying stadiums and pools from the 2004 Games. We've got the ruins of ancient Olympia in Greece, said historian Miles Osgood, but now we've got the ruins of modern Olympia. Is there a more sustainable way? Paris 2024 was promoted as the most sustainable tournament yet. Temporary structures were used to turn historic landmarks into venues. Beach volleyball was played by the Eiffel Tower. Judo bouts happened at the Champs de Mars. And existing facilities were refurbished and reused. With a total cost of $10 billion, Paris was the cheapest summer games in a quarter century. But this stripped-back approach is possible only in cities with ample pre-existing infrastructure. It will be very, very unlikely that we will see another city from an emerging economy or one that hasn't hosted the Games already stage a new edition of the Games, said Oxford University economist Alexander Budzier. The next Summer Games in 2028 will take place in Los Angeles, which was selected after Budapest, Hamburg, Germany, and Rome pulled out of bidding over budget concerns. How is L.A. faring? Local leaders have pledged not to leave the city saddled with debt. As in 1984, Los Angeles aims to use existing facilities, and officials estimate the total cost of the event will come in at about $7 billion. That figure has swelled 30% since L.A. secured hosting rights in 2017. But sports economist Andrew Zimbalist said there's still a decent chance that L.A. is going to break even. But many residents and experts wonder if spending on the games is the best use of resources. With swaths of the city still struggling to rebuild from the devastating 2025 wildfires, an ongoing homelessness crisis, and the city's nearly $1 billion budget deficit, given what the city and the region now face, said Joel Kotkin, a fellow in the urban studies at Chapman University, why would you want to put more stress on it? Time for a few of the best columns. First two come from the U.S. The high price of vaccine avoidance. A measles outbreak is exploding in South Carolina, said Jonathan Cohn, and Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. couldn't care less. The state has had nearly 900 reported cases of the infectious disease, the largest outbreak in the U.S. in decades. Measles outbreaks are popping up in pockets where people have low vaccination rates in Florida, Texas, California, and Ohio. asked if he was concerned about the U.S. losing the elimination status on measles it gained through vaccination in 2000, CDC official Ralph Abraham responded, "Not really." Under Kennedy, the CDC has promoted the idea that measles is no big deal. But while most children and adults recover after 2 weeks of rashes, high fevers, and misery, the disease can cause complications such as swelling of the brain and pneumonia and can require hospitalization. Before vaccination, about 48,000 Americans were hospitalized with measles every year, with 400 to 500 deaths. Many others suffered the virus's long-term effects, which can include blindness, hearing loss, immune suppression, and seizures. Thanks to Kennedy's crusade to spread vaccine misinformation and fear, an outbreak like this one in South Carolina could very well be coming to a neighborhood near you. No, Russia isn't winning in Ukraine. Russia is putting enormous effort into convincing President Trump, the American public, and the rest of the world that its conquest of Ukraine is inevitable, said Jim Garrity. But that's pure Kremlin propaganda. In reality, Ukrainian forces are still fighting like hellions and inflicting casualties on its invader at an astonishing rate. According to a recent Center for Strategic and International Studies report, Russia has sustained more than 1.2 million casualties in 4 years of war. Meanwhile, Vladimir Putin's army has only advanced between 15 and 70 meters per day since early 2024. That's quite literally the pace of a snail, which can reach a top speed of 25 meters per day. Russia's economy, meanwhile, is struggling, with huge labor shortages because of all the young men serving and dying in Ukraine, soaring inflation, plummeting oil revenues, reduced wages, and rising taxes. Ukraine has also suffered huge losses, but remains shorthanded in personnel, ammunition, and weapons. But Ukrainians remain defiant and are using drones with incredible creativity and effectiveness. If Donald Trump thinks Kyiv is so weak it will accept a peace deal dictated by his pal Putin, he is sadly mistaken. This column comes from Israel. Who needs U.S. military aid anyway? Europeans aren't the only ones who are realizing they can no longer count on the U.S., said Lev Stessin. Israelis are starting to feel the same way. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he won't fully renew the annual $3.8 billion U.S. military aid package when it comes up for a review in 2 years. In fact, he sees Israel weaning itself off U.S. aid altogether within a decade. That may seem foolish, but it's the natural conclusion of a long and painful reevaluation of U.S. reliability. America is tragically divided into a permanent state of cultural civil war, making Washington's policies in the Middle East increasingly resemble the acts of a schizophrenic patient. In 2 years, we've seen the pendulum swing from Joe Biden's partial weapons embargo on Israel to Donald Trump's joining with Israel in its strikes against Iran. A welcome pivot, but a temporary one. The hostile reactions to the Gaza war inside the U.S. have caused the long-standing consensus supporting Israel to fracture, and that once-powerful lobby, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC, to lose its clout. But Israel needn't mourn. Will soon be a trillion-dollar economy. We can survive and prosper on our own. We can remain a close U.S. friend, but an independent friend, not a friend in need. And the last word, our in-depth article, censored in the classroom. Summer Bosmer fought an Oklahoma law that barred teachers from her like her from discussing divisive concepts in school, said Dana Goldstein in the New York Times. Now she may never teach again. Summer Bosmer hauled open the garage door of her storage unit and searched for the boxes of books that ended her career. She lugged a few into the trunk of her car and drove to her mom's suburban house in Yukon, Oklahoma, where she now lives. Kneeling on the rug in the living room, she began peeling off the dried packing tape, opening the cardboard tops for the first time since she had closed them in 2022. In 8 years and one day of teaching public school in her home state, Bosmer, 37, had amassed a 500-volume classroom library procured on her $58,000 salary. She lent the books to students in an effort to get them reading something that sparked their interest in a screen-addled world. She began pulling books out to show a reporter. Night, The Sound and the Fury, Lord of the Flies, but also more contemporary choices. Long Way Down, about a black teenager confronting gun violence and racism. The Girl from the Sea, a lesbian coming-of-age graphic novel. She remembered when one student, who was often absent, took her copy of March, about the life of John Lewis, and never returned it. Bosmer didn't mind. Recommending a book that a teenager fell in love with was a high like no other, she said. When Oklahoma passed laws that pressured teachers to remove books on race, gender, and sexuality from their classroom, she refused. Other teachers resisted too, but Bosmer did so loudly. She plastered her 10th grade English classroom with signs of protest, posted to social media, and advised her students on how they could find books online. Eventually, she resigned. She knew that in her conservative state she would be criticized, but the reaction was much more severe than she expected. And in 2024, the state took away Bosmer's teaching license. It was an extraordinary punishment. More than 20 states, including Oklahoma, have passed laws over the past 5 years restricting the curriculum around race, gender, sexuality, and American history. Hundreds of teachers have faced discipline or lost their jobs as a result of these laws, but Bosmer is perhaps the only one whose certification has been fully revoked. She was accused of bringing politics into the classroom, and in a way, she doesn't dispute that. What it was about for me, she said, was my students would understand where I stood on the issue of censorship. Without a license, she cannot teach public school in Oklahoma. The revocation also makes it difficult for her to become certified in other states, in part because it's a punishment generally used in egregious cases such as child abuse or fraud. Bosmer tried to start a new life in New York outside the classroom, but last year she returned to Oklahoma. This fall, she filed a federal lawsuit against the state and the man who led the charge against her, Ryan Walters, the former state superintendent, arguing that her free speech and due process rights had been violated. Sprawled on the living room floor, she surveyed the books around her. Some of the spines hadn't even been cracked. Trying to find, like, a purpose and a reason for getting out of bed every morning can be challenging, she said. I love working with high school students. Bosmer grew up west of Oklahoma City among a conservative family who for a time attended a Southern Baptist church. When her mother took Bosmer and her two sisters to the library after school, they could choose any books they wanted, a thrilling freedom that defined her childhood. After studying English at the University of Oklahoma, she eventually became a high school teacher in the small town of Piedmont. In 2018, Bosmer was named her school's Teacher of the Year, and more awards followed, including one from the state. She led student groups, including the Gay-Straight Alliance. When she assigned a raisin in the sun, she prompted students to consider why their own area was so overwhelmingly white. She taught them about the history of sundown towns, which essentially barred black people from home ownership by not allowing them to be present after dark. In 2020, the state's Republican governor, Kevin Stitt, appointed Walters as the state secretary of education. Walters had been a popular U.S. history teacher. His students had little idea of his personal views, but he would later say he had been shaped by seeing fellow educators inject liberal ideas into the classroom. Once in office, he pivoted to a harder right Christian conservative agenda, directing public schools to teach the Bible. In 2021, he became a primary supporter of the bill that changed Bosmer's life, HB 1775, one of the first laws of its kind nationwide. The Oklahoma law barred public school teachers from discussing a long list of so-called divisive concepts related to race and sex, borrowing language from an executive order signed by President Trump in 2020. The legislature also passed a law requiring that books in school be age-appropriate, a term that was not defined. Walter sought to reassure critics that the nation's full history could still be discussed, including incidents of discrimination, but there was real pressure on schools. In the summer of 2022, the State Board of Education threatened to strip two districts of their accreditation because of lessons and staff training sessions about privilege and implicit bias. By then, Bosmer had moved to a new job as a 10th grade English teacher at Norman High School in Norman, Oklahoma. That August, she was setting up her classroom for the year ahead when she and other English teachers were called into a meeting. Norman High's principal, Hallie Wright, told teachers the district was worried about the new laws and advised that they carefully review and call their classroom libraries. The assistant principal, Greg Willis, suggested teachers could cover classroom bookshelves with paper or turn book spines inward, according to Bosmer's court filings. Each teacher was also presented with a document to sign attesting that they had reviewed all books in their classroom for appropriateness on a broad range of topics: drinking, drugs, tobacco, mental health, sex, racial sensitivity, frightening content, violence, language, religion, and weapons. Bosmer watched several colleagues pack their book collections into boxes, realizing that many of the other teachers had mortgages to pay and children to support. They might have objected to the new rules, but they couldn't afford to lose a job. Bosmer was renting an apartment. She was unmarried and didn't have kids. Somebody should protest this, she thought. In the days before school was set to open, Bosmer covered her classroom shelves with bright red butcher's paper and a handwritten message: "Books the state doesn't want you to read." She posted a blown-up QR code that linked to the Brooklyn Public Library's Books Unbanned project, which provided any teenager in America with digital access to the library's full catalog. At the end of each class on the first day of school, she gestured toward the display and told students she was no longer allowed to lend out the books. She also pointed out the QR code. A parent complained that day, Friday. After school, the principal told Bosmer not to report to her classroom. Monday morning, when she met with the district's head of human resources the next week, she told her she could return to the classroom, but her protests could not. In the district's view, Bosmer had improperly brought personal political statements into the classroom. She left the meeting and called her mother. How could she not protest what she saw as censorship? Bosmer resigned. In the following days, her phone pinged constantly with social media messages, emails, and interview requests from national media outlets. She told reporters she did not regret her actions. "I would do it again in a heartbeat," she said. Some Norman parents rallied to support her, putting up yard signs with the Brooklyn Public Library QR code. But others were angry. In one TV interview, the parent of a student in Bosmer's class noted the Brooklyn Public Library was promoting an event to discuss Genderqueer, a coming-of-age memoir about the author's discovering their non-binary gender identity, with illustrations of sex. "This is pornographic material," the mother said, adding that Bosmer should be stripped of her certifications. "To be perfectly frank with you, she should have criminal charges against her." Walters, who was in running to be state superintendent, posted a video to Twitter. "What matters is that teachers don't indoctrinate our kids," he said. He sent a letter to the State Board of Education asking them to revoke her teaching certificate. Vosmer began to receive a flood of threatening messages. Pedophile, groomer, die. But she was also becoming a liberal darling. She spoke on an anti-censorship panel and received messages of support from across the country. The Brooklyn Public Library offered her a job. She accepted. As her grandparents drove her to the airport, she carefully took in the strip malls and big starry skies she had seen 10,000 times. She thought she might never live in Oklahoma again. Meanwhile, Walters and allies in the state government were continuing to pursue a revocation of her teaching certificate. In June 2023, the state held an administrative hearing to consider Walters' case against Vosmer. She attended from New York over Zoom, where she was repeatedly asked to comment on sexually explicit illustrations from genderqueer. Taken as a whole, she eventually said she believed genderqueer was appropriate for high school students, though she denied a report that she had the book in her classroom. When she was asked if she could teach in Oklahoma while HB 1775 remained law, she said, "I would say, for me personally, absolutely not." Her lawyer argued, however, that while she had protested the law, she had not broken it. The hearing officer, Liz Stevens, a state assistant attorney general, ruled Vosmer should keep her license, noting there was no evidence she had used any banned titles in her instruction or had ever given those books directly to students. But the ruling was just a recommendation. And a year later, members of the State Board of Education, led by Walters, voted unanimously to end her right to teach public school. Vosmer wrote on the social platform X that losing her license felt a bit like losing a fundamental part of myself. By then, she had been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, which she said was related to the years-long fight in Oklahoma. She had already left her job at the library. She decided to leave New York and move into her mother's ranch house. She also decided to sue. One lawsuit for defamation was dismissed, but she filed two others in state and federal courts to have her certification reinstated. She was determined to fight for the right of students to read widely, but she veered between hope and despondency as she wondered what work she would be allowed to do or when she might be able to afford her own apartment again. "I genuinely am not sure what's next for me," she said. In September, Walter stepped down as state superintendent before his term ended, amid accusations of politicizing the classroom and mismanaging the state education department. The new superintendent, Lyndon Fields, said he would reverse course on requiring Bibles in classrooms. The state will also drop an effort to screen out teachers' candidates with liberal beliefs. But Vosmer's case lies in a gray area. In their private lives, public school teachers generally have the right to political speech. But in the classroom, their free speech is curtailed, and they must teach the curriculum set by their states and districts. In its revocation order, the State Board of Education did not claim that Vosmer was teaching a restricted book or concept. Instead, it said that she had intended to entice her students to read prohibited books in violation of HB 1775. Vosmer's lawsuits could take months or years to conclude. Her lawyer said she was in discussions with the state about the possibility of Vosmer regaining her license. She is also seeking back pay and damages. Vosmer is not sure that her future lies in Oklahoma. Over the past year, she has applied for jobs that don't require a public school teaching license, at nonprofits, working for private charter schools, and has been turned down again and again. On a recent weekday, her mother, Christy Vosmer, arrived home from work to find her daughter still surrounded by boxes of books and mementos from her teaching life. "Having summer home had been wonderful," she said, "but Christy knows the future is likely apart. I just don't think," Christy said, "that it would ever be possible for her to work in this state again." This was adapted from an article that originally appeared in the New York Times. Read one of the obituaries for you. The Sanford and Son actor who became a preacher, Damon Wilson, 1946 to 2026. Damon Wilson was on TV only about a decade, but he had a substantial impact. His NBC show Sanford and Son was just the second major sitcom with a mostly black cast. The first was the stereotypical 1950s Amos and Andy, and it was a runaway hit. Wilson played Lamont, the put-upon, hot-headed son of a cantankerous junkman dad, played large by the raunchy comedian Red Fox. Lamont was mostly the straight man, referred to dismissively with a, "Hey, dummy," but the plots often revolved around his emotions and aspiration, and his wry wit was evident every time he spoke out of the corner of his mouth. In one memorable episode, he got to show off the smooth tap dancing skills that were a legacy of a childhood spent on the stage. "My mother put me in these schools," he said in 2024. "You had to sing, you had to dance, you had to act, and you had to speak well, with elocution." Born in Georgia to a working-class Catholic family, Grady Damon Wilson grew up in Harlem, where his parents moved soon after his birth. He took dance and acting classes from toddlerhood, appearing on Broadway at age 4 and dancing at the Apollo Theater at age 12. That's when he nearly died from a ruptured appendix, said the New York Times, and he made a secret promise at that time that he would eventually devote his life to God. After an army tour in Vietnam, he got his big break when Norman Lear cast him in an episode of All in the Family, and then in 1972 as co-lead in Sanford, another Lear production. An instant rating smash, said the Chicago Sun-Times. The show opened the door for other black family shows to move into the virtually all-white TV neighborhood. Sanford and Son wrapped up in 1977, and Wilson went on to star in two short-lived sitcoms, playing an estranged husband in Baby, I'm Back, and the slob Oscar Madison in The New Odd Couple. Yet such roles weren't enough to fulfill him. He gave up acting, sold his Bel Air mansion and Rolls Royce, and became a Pentecostal minister, said the Los Angeles Times. For the rest of his life, Wilson dismissed his work in television. "Hollywood doesn't mean anything to me," he said in 2023. "I didn't belong there." Here's one of the health and science short pieces. Grandparenting for a sharp brain. To keep your brain sharp as you age, a new study suggests you try looking after the grandchildren. Researchers analyzed data from the English Longitudinal Study of Aging, tracking 2,887 grandparents with an average age of 67 between 2016 and 2022. They found that those who were actively involved in child care, from playing and preparing meals to helping with homework, consistently performed better on cognitive tests. Non-caregiving grandparents saw their memory scores fall more sharply over time, while caregiving grandparents experienced only modest declines. A similar pattern emerged for verbal fluency, measured by how many animals participants could name in 1 minute. The benefits, which were most apparent in grandmothers, appeared regardless of how regularly grandparents helped out or what kind of care they provided. Lead author Flavia Cherechis from Tilburg University in the Netherlands tells The Times, "Being a caregiving grandparent seems to matter more for cognitive functioning than how often grandparents provided care or what exactly they did with their grandchildren." The tools of the ancients. Early humans in Europe were making tools from bone and wood hundreds of thousands of years before Homo sapiens arrived on the continent, according to two new studies that push back the timeline for early technology. The first study describes a 430,000-year-old set of wooden tools uncovered in southern Greece, a digging stick made from alder and a carved twig of poplar or willow, both bearing a clear cut and carving marks. The site also contains stone tools and the remains of an extinct straight-tusked elephant. The second study focuses on a 500,000-year-old hammer made from elephant or mammoth bone, excavated at the Box Grove Paleolithic site in southern England. The 4-inch implement was apparently used for napping stone tools, and wear patterns and embedded flint fragments show it was repeatedly struck against stone. Both sets of artifacts were probably made by early Neanderthals or an earlier species, Homo heidelbergensis, which lived in Europe long before Homo sapiens spread there from Africa around 210,000 years ago. German archaeologist Thomas Turberger tells the New York Times that the finds show the range of materials early humans used and suggests that many other tools failed to survive. Imagine how many tools you can make from a single large bone of an elephant. In one of the Talking Points articles, Melania, a film about nothing. Amazon's new Melania Trump documentary promised it would reveal the real woman behind the First Lady's steely exterior, said Monica Hess in the Washington Post. But after sitting through this 104-minute exercise in superficiality, I can report there's nothing to see. Melania, which follows the First Lady as she prepares for Donald Trump's second inauguration, is filled with scenes of the inscrutable ex-model trying on hats, strutting down hallways, in stilettos that never come off, and attending meetings about place settings and invitations. Director Brett Ratner, exiled from Hollywood after being accused of sexual misconduct by multiple women, never unearths what Melania actually thinks about a return to the White House, or anything else. It doesn't matter. Hiding her true personality is, in fact, her personality. Despite its vapidity, Melania took in $7 million in its first weekend, the strongest opening for a documentary in a decade, said Sam Adams in Slate. That would be impressive if Amazon hadn't spent an unprecedented $40 million buying the documentary and another $35 million marketing it. There's an old Hollywood term for a $75 million movie that opens with a $7 million in box office, a flop. Melania isn't a documentary, said Alexandre Petri in The Atlantic. It's a horror movie. This is the tale of a woman who experiences none of the things that make life worth living. Meaningful conversations, shared laughter, petting a dog, casual interactions with someone who's neither an employee nor a family member. In their place are fittings, more fittings, pomp, private jets, expensively attired billionaires being served. I am not making this up. Golden eggs. Melania is trapped in an invisible bubble she will never be able to escape. And she hasn't even noticed. Please don't mistake her for a victim, said Maureen Dowd in the New York Times. The Slovenian Sphinx is not, as some liberals have fantasized, Rapunzel in the tower, pining to be saved from the ogre imprisoning her. She is comfortable with her husband's authoritarianism and comfortable in the frosty vertical solitude of the tower, swaddled in luxury. There is no reason for Melania to exist outside of rank corruption, said Sonny Bunch in The Bulwark. Amazon founder Jeff Bezos spent $40 million buying this hagiography, $28 million of which went to Melania, in the clear hope of protecting his companies from government interference. It's all quite disgusting. But it's also quite fascinating to see just how many Americans will trek to a theater to bask in the golden glow of Trump Tower, and how such a pure and naked instrument of graft and propaganda can be deployed to great effect on an audience happy to lap it up. And a few of the short notes. About 10,100 doctoral-trained experts in science and related fields left jobs with the federal government last year. That exodus represents about 14% of all PhDs in science, technology, engineering, math, or health fields employed by the government at the end of 2024. President Trump wants to build a 250-foot-tall Independence Arch in Washington, D.C., to commemorate the 250th anniversary of the U.S. The structure would sit near the Memorial Bridge and would dwarf the nearby 100-foot Lincoln Memorial. Life expectancy in the U.S. hit a record 79 years in 2024 as a result of the waning COVID pandemic and also lower death rates from heart disease, cancer, overdoses, and other top killers. Life expectancy peaked at just below 79 years in 2014, then plunged to 76.5 years during the pandemic. The use of the terms hate, LGBT, and white, black, Latino, Latina in Democratic platforms increased by more than 1,000% from 2012 to 2024. The use of responsibility and middle class fell 83 and 79%, respectively. And we'll wrap up today's show with a quote from Iris Murdoch, quoted in The New Yorker, who says, "Love is the extremely difficult realization that someone or something other than yourself is real." With that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Please join us again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Week magazine is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.